Today at Reader's Corner, Aaron David Miller, author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Washington, Lincoln, and FDR are revered as leaders who helped shape the course of history. They are often referred to as the great presidents. But is it possible to have a great president today? And is greatness a quality that Americans even want in their chief executive today? Aaron David Miller examines the history of the U.S. presidency to explore those questions in his book, The End of Greatness. In the book, Dr. Miller makes the case that greatness as a presidential virtue is largely overrated and that it occurs too infrequently to be relevant to current politics. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. Miller. He is Vice President for New Initiatives and a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. For two decades, he served as an advisor to Republican and Democratic Secretaries of State. His pieces on the presidency have appeared in many national publications, and he appears regularly on the BBC, NPR, CNN, and other major media outlets. We selected The End of Greatness for this program prior to the November 2016 general election, not knowing who would win the presidency or what the national mood would be. As historians begin to assess the Obama legacy and President Trump and his administration settle into the White House, Dr. Miller's book offers a thoughtful perspective on how the concept of greatness plays out at the highest levels of government. Dr. Miller joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Aaron David Miller, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, truly.
Well, could we start off with just this idea of greatness? You landed on FDR and Lincoln and Washington. I don't think many people will quibble with you about that, but I did notice in the middle of your book you mentioned Where They Stand, the book by Robert Mary, who has taken a look at rating presidents and has done so by looking back in history at what their vote totals were and their approval ratings, but also looking at the collective judgment of American historians. As you found your way through our American presidents, did you use his metrics or are these your metrics?
Historians and political scientists, pundits, journalists have been playing the presidential rating game for at least 60 or 70 years. It began actually in the 1940s under Arthur Schlesinger Sr., and it was continued by his son as well. And it's a popular game. I would argue to you it's a useful game. I think Americans ought to be more interested in trying to take a historical perspective and evaluating their presidents. I identified three characteristics of what I call, and I didn't use quantitative analysis to do this. This is more an analytical look, mm-hmm. And I try to make it as accessible as I possibly could, a kind of friendly conversation between me and the reader on the issue of greatness in the presidency. So I identify three factors which I argue in the book produce what I call undeniable greatness. And I think those three, Washington, Lincoln, and FDR, and there's very little doubt, and there's no margin among historians of whatever political party for running these three down. They are truly undeniably great presidents, in my judgment, because of what I call the three C's of presidential greatness. First of all, they had each of their tenures coincided with a major crisis in America's political history, a crisis that was so hot, so irrepressible, so uncertain that the very fabric of the nation was threatened. That crisis opens the door to the possibility of the accumulation of power and the acquiescence by the political elites and the public at large if the president has the other two qualities, the other two C's. One is character and the other is capacity. So crisis opens the door. And the founders were very wise on this one. On one hand, they feared great men. Benjamin Rush, who signed the Constitution, said that it was, other than pestilence and famine, great men were to be feared. They wanted to prevent any single individual from accumulating enough power to threaten them. Their adversaries at the times were the King of England and the royal governors. So you had 13 colonies, which essentially were separate entities. Washington's greatness, frankly, was his extraordinary capacity to navigate these times, to create institutions and a political culture which struck the balance between the accumulation of too much power by the central government and not enough power, which would have meant that the emerging United States would probably not have emerged. Lincoln, of course, confronted the greatest crisis of all, the Civil War, and FDR, the Great Depression, and guiding the United States through the Second World War. So crisis character and capacity. And I'm arguing that since FDR, and all of these men, by the way, had fundamental asterisks by their name. I mean, it's not as if they were saints and they were not judged even at the time, certainly in the case of Lincoln and FDR, to be saints. Washington was another matter. A group of clergy literally wanted to take his farewell address and make it an annex to the Bible. I mean, Washington was revered in his time. Not since FDR, in my judgment, have we seen the alignment of crisis, character, and capacity that would have created circumstances to create this kind of undeniable greatness in the present.
And FDR set, as you say, a very high bar for anybody who wants to come after him and declare greatness.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the problem. You know, the Republicans figured when they passed the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, which restricted a president to two terms, that they were probably getting back at FDR. I mean, after all, my mother used to tell me that, FDR was the only president she knew. I mean, that was almost four terms, which is extraordinary. But FDR's bar, his accomplishments are so extraordinary. He didn't navigate the U.S. out of the Great Depression, but his leadership, his confidence really buoyed the nation through some very dark times. And then, of course, he did lead the United States through the last war, frankly, that left the United States stronger at home and abroad. There hasn't been a war subsequently that has met those two conditions. So besting FDR, being a greater president than Franklin Roosevelt, with all of his imperfections, and there were several critical ones, is really a goal that no president has ever met and probably none ever will.
And to the point about crisis, I believe one of your points is that how we define a crisis is very important here. You seem to be saying that the crises which confronted FDR simply haven't happened again. And I wonder if you could help us explain what you think a crisis has to be before it rises to the occasion of defining a president as it did FDR.
I mean, look, it's not as if we haven't had crises, both domestic and foreign, since 1945. I mean, we've watched the civil rights movement. We've watched our cities burn. We've watched 9/11. But the crisis I'm describing is a national crisis. It's so hot, so irrepressible, so nation-encumbering that it's impossible to sit it out. Let me just give you an example. We are now still engaged in fighting, literally. We have deployment of American forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, the two longest wars in American history. Those wars are being fought by 0.5% of a country of 330 million people. When my father went to war in 1941 in the South Pacific, there were 130 million Americans, 16 million of them put on a uniform. It was, accompanied by the Great Depression, the other defining characteristics of that generation. And I would argue to you that subsequently, and I'm not arguing that there are good wars, but subsequently, we simply have not had the kind of crisis that has energized and involved the nation as a whole. I mean, even the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I remember I was 12 at the time, we were told to hide under our desks at elementary school. It lasted for 12 days, the crisis between Khrushchev and Kennedy. It really was, for 12 days, the first and only time the U.S. and the former Soviet Union confronted the real possibility of a nuclear exchange over the stationing of Soviet ICBMs in Cuba. But that only lasted 12 days, and the result of that crisis was that the U.S. and the former Soviet Union, now Russia, more or less vowed and pledged that they would never again allow themselves to come to that point. Even 9/11, which was extraordinarily tragic, was a crisis that in many respects didn't lead to national participation, introspection, national service. In fact, paradoxically, it led to the reverse. You had, instead of an inclusive sense of selflessness and sacrifice and willingness to serve, it became exclusive, a volunteer military, the creation of a national security establishment that became very inward-looking. So I guess I'm arguing in the end, Bob, that frankly that's a good thing. The book is called The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have, parent, and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Because my bottom line is very clear. You want greatness of the kind of a Washington, Lincoln, and FDR? Well, then you better buckle your seatbelt. Because chances are that kind of greatness would require a crisis that threatens the nation. And frankly, given the decline of our political class and the absence of greatness in our politics, do you really want to risk the fate of the nation on the assumption that another man or woman would emerge to lead the nation through such a crisis? I mean, when you think about it, it's extraordinary that the three greatest challenges to this country, one in each century, 18th, 19th, and 20th, saw the emergence of an individual, however flawed, let's be clear, however flawed they were, that was able and willing to lead the nation through that crisis. I find that stunning, actually.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Aaron David Miller. He's the author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. You also suggest that third common element, capacity, the know-how to run government, to put the coalitions together to get things done, is much more difficult today, and I believe you call it an ungovernable nation. Walk us through the issues of polarization and incivility that we know all too well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many things that create that, and I think we're entering a period of bitter partisanship. We're really in, you know, I'm reminded that great quote from Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz when she lands and she turns to the little dog and says, "Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore." Well, we're not in Kansas anymore. And I think that the capacity of an individual to govern has been challenged by several key circumstances. One is the fact that if you asked an American in 1968, as Gallup did, do you trust your government to do the right thing most of the time? The responses were in the high 60s. You ask that same question today, and I think you'll break double digits. Secondly, the notion that government is a remedy, and let's be clear, whether it's big government, medium-sized government, or small government, that government is designed to, has an obligation to help individuals in some capacity, that notion has been fundamentally and centrally challenged. And large institutions, whether they're corporations, banks, you look at the two largest protest movements in the last decade, the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. They are both challenges to the notion of big institutions. And even while Americans, even though they clearly realize it, they may not want to admit it, that 75% of us rely on some form of government assistance, whether it's mortgage deductions or Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, 75% of us. One of the most anomalous things I saw in Washington during the demonstration by the Tea Party was a sign that said, "Barack Obama, don't touch my Medicare." And I'm thinking to myself, you know, people want to hark back to a smaller era where government was essentially the U.S. Postal Service. In the 20s or 30s, most Americans' experience with the federal government was their experience with the delivery of the mail. And government has grown. It's a central part of our lives. And yet people are, in some respects, are hostile to it. And finally is the issue of the media. And the media does not make or break great presidents, but it creates a real challenge because presidents are covered now 24/7. They are in a fishbowl. Every aspect is covered, and with that kind of coverage, it's hard to maintain the kind of image of detachment and greatness that is required. And, you know, Barack Obama goes on Jay Linhaeus, and I think it was 2010, and he gets into a conversation talking about sports, and he says, "I bowled a 129, and the president of the United States says, "I guess that's maybe good enough for the Special Olympics," which is something obviously he should not have said. He finds himself apologizing the next day. The notion that somehow once a president goes on national television and appears on Saturday Night Live, it's funny, it's smart politics, but it also trivializes. It also trivializes the president. And finally is the issue of overexposure. I mean, Lincoln gives 4 or 5 speeches during his entire presidency, great speeches. And yet a president during his first year might, in one form or another, press conferences, messages, written and oral, radio interviews, basically are in the hundreds. So I think the media, by and large, makes it very hard to maintain that image of authority and greatness that existed in our past presidents, among some of our past presidents.
You know, I have to inject Trump into this part of the conversation. I know, of course, that the reason he took on the media as he did just recently is that he simply doesn't like the fact that they don't agree with him. But there was a moment as I was reading your book and watching Trump adjust to the presidency. His wife wants to live in New York. He's going to spend a lot of time in New York. They probably won't use the White House the way they used to. And I thought, you know, there is something to what he's doing here that is depersonalizing the office in a way that no one has ever done before him. And we could argue whether it's a good thing or not. But any thoughts on that?
You know, I think the question here is, you know, all presidents reshape their presidencies, all right, in many respects in their own image. They pursue policies, they give speeches. That's been a tradition throughout our history. The real challenge and concern is whether or not a president-elect could reshape the nature of the office itself and do things and say things that somehow make it less prestigious and less of a resilient institution. It's proven to be extraordinarily resilient. It survived a major constitutional crisis in Watergate. It survived the demeaning of the presidency under Bill Clinton during the Monica Lewinsky affair. It survived numerous challenges. The very nature of the office, however, and let's be clear, Americans, you know, the Europeans do great. Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, Frederick the Great, Charlemagne. We don't want greatness when it comes to the trappings of greatness and the fancy attributes of greatness. We want what I would describe to you as uncommon greatness. So Jefferson answers his own door, much to the dismay of the British ambassador who finds him in his bedroom slippers, literally answering his own door. Grover Cleveland is answering his own phone in the 1880s. Harry Truman, believe it or not, in 1953, after he steps down from office, packs up his wife, Bess, in a Chrysler that someone, New Yorker, and the two of them, with no Secret Service, no advance team, no press, drive, you know, 1,200 miles through Michigan and up the East Coast. He eats in diners. He stopped on the New Jersey Turnpike and ticketed. I mean, that's the image of a kind of uncommon greatness that Americans prefer. It's just that the White House, the presidency, has long been an object not just of fascination, but in some respect, since it's the only national office, the one office, including the vice president, that all Americans vote for. It's an institution that needs to be respected and treated with the utmost, it seems to me, of reverence and regard. And let me just make one point. It belongs to all of us. The pronoun I appears once in the Constitution of the United States. I didn't know this until someone, when I was researching this book, asked me the question. Why does the word I appear anywhere in the U.S. Constitution? I had no idea. The answer is that the founders embedded the inaugural oath that the president will take on January 20th in Article 2, the oath. And what that means to me is that the power and the authority of the president doesn't flow from the president. The power and the authority of the president doesn't even flow from the Constitution. It flows from the ultimate source of authority, which is us. And each president owes us at a minimum, the obligation to serve and to treat the office with the respect and regard that it deserves. After all, these men, all men so far, live in a museum in which they are literally working at the desks, sitting surrounded by the furniture of the greats. And it's a powerful, powerful experience. And it needs to be looked at and preserved in that fashion as well.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Aaron David Miller about his book, The End of Greatness. He is vice president for new initiatives at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. So as we conclude the Obama presidency, and I believe your book addressed the Obama presidency, but for the most part, the first term, and now that we're finished with the second term, I wonder if you'd comment on how Obama's presidency measures up, maybe the word, maybe it's not, but in what context you put the Obama presidency when you look at this issue of greatness?
I mean, I think it's going to require more time in order to come to terms and to grips with the Obama presidency. Who precedes you and who follows you? It's critically important to where you will ultimately sit in the presidential pantheon. I mean, Barack Obama is clearly a historic president. He's the first African-American president, and I don't care whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent or what party you belong to. We did something in 2008, whether you like Barack Obama or you don't, is irrelevant. We did something in 2008 that no other democracy in the world has ever been able to do, certainly no consequential democracy. We elected, finally, a man of color whose wife is a direct descendant of slaves and who himself is still despised and I'm certain of it by millions of his fellow citizens, even though he was elected once and reelected. And that's extraordinary. It demonstrates an amazing capacity of our system, which is remarkable. You can literally come from nowhere. Donald Trump is another example of how extraordinary the system is, that you can rise with no experience in politics, and some would argue this is fundamentally a terrible development. I'm not entirely sure that's the case, but you can rise from nowhere with respect to politics or the lack of experience in governance, and you can become the president. Now, you can choose to interpret that any way you want, but I think Barack Obama's place in history for who he was is assured. The question that needs to be answered is, will he be remembered as a consequential president for what he did? Forget who he is, for what he did. And, you know, his detractors will argue that he was a terrible president, that on so many issues he failed and failed miserably. His acolytes and supporters will argue that he was tremendously consequential. He inherited the two longest wars in American history and the worst economic dislocation since the Great Depression. And he coped and he managed. The administration was scandal-free. He's leaving office with a very high approval rating. I suspect in the end that he will be well-remembered by probably a majority of Americans for inheriting a bad hand, coping with that bad hand. I made mistakes. But treating the office of the presidency with the respect and dignity that it deserves. But again, it usually takes years to examine the full scope and implications of a president's time in office. And given the fact that many of this president's accomplishments are now going to be under strain and threat as his successor seeks to amend, revise, or push the country in another direction, the evaluation of his presidency is still very much an open question.
You seem to have given President-elect a pretty good piece of advice in your analysis of the Obama campaign, the first campaign and his early days as president. He was oftentimes referring to Lincoln. He was oftentimes mentioning FDR. And I believe your point was that he set himself up for a very difficult standard, and it gets me to your conclusion. You have a couple of interesting points maybe we could close on where you suggest to the readers that they should think good, not great, and that they should think transaction, not transformation.
Yeah, I mean, I think, thanks, Bob, for raising that. And when I say good, I don't mean good in the banal, commonplace, throwaway sense of the word. I mean good in three respects. Good in the fact that these are good people who have good values, who understand the difference between right and wrong, and who function well within the mainstream of the constitutional and moral parameters that the country expects. Second, good in the sense that they're good at something, that they're effective, that they're competent managers and can handle the job. And then finally, good in the sense that they're good at understanding who they are. The fashionable word will be emotional intelligence. President haunted by personal demons, and we've seen several examples of those in the past, can lead the country down a path that could be quite harmful. I'm not a religious person, but I'm a follower of the great Protestant theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. And Niebuhr wrote years ago that the best we can do is proximate solutions to insoluble problems. That's how I see the American story. You know, we love to fashion ourselves conducting wars against terror, wars against poverty, wars against guns, wars against mental illness, and wars against cancer, and hopefully the war against cancer, since so many people have suffered, including my own parents, from this terrible disease. The war on cancer will be one, but the other problems that confront us in this country, they're all works in progress. We may never solve them, but we can, in fact, close the gap between the way we are as Americans and the way we really want to be. I think closing that gap is partly the American story. So I don't believe in transformations. I don't think Barack Obama transformed the country. I don't think President-elect Donald Trump will transform the country either. And I urge people to think about transaction, finding solutions as best you can, or making progress toward addressing the things that ail, the slow bleeds. We don't face existential crises anymore in this country, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing because we had presidents along the way that guided us through these moments, and we passed them. But we have slow bleeds in this country, infrastructure that needs repair, an educational system that needs to be addressed. We have to do something with respect to controlling our borders and immigration reform. We do have to address, it's a long struggle, the problem of climate change. We have to get a grip on entitlements, and serious tax reform is required, and we have to protect the nation's interests abroad. I mean, these are all things that, these are slow bleeds. None of these things are going to kill this country. And I think, you know, Lincoln said, and perhaps it's appropriate to close here, Lincoln said in his speech to the Young Men's Lyceum before he became president that the real threat facing America, and remember, he's writing now in the mid-19th century, he said something, and I'm paraphrasing, that no great power will ever drink of the Ohio River. No great power will ever set foot on the Appalachian Trail. The real threat, Lincoln argued, is that we Americans, will either be the authors of our own salvation or the authors of our own destruction. We will live as free men and women, of course, or we will die by suicide. Lincoln was onto something, and I think it's an important question to consider as we face the inauguration of our next president.
Aaron, that pretty much takes up our time. Thank you so much for coming on to the show, and most importantly for the book. The book is The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President by Aaron David Miller. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Aaron David Miller. Next week, Mark Levinson, author of An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Post-War Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.